Well, hey, this is Dave. Welcome. Everybody's early. I appreciate that. Thanks for your promptness. I'm really excited about our group. We have a small group, which gives us an opportunity to have more interaction, more case discussion. I'd like to spend the most of our time today giving you an introduction and mostly getting to have each of you introduce yourselves before I move into the material. So I'll talk some about what we are going to do as a group and the training, and then move into our first seminar. But first, let's get each of you to introduce yourselves. Amy, would you start?
Hi, this is Amy Callen. I'm from Dallas, Texas. I'm very excited to be a part of this class, and I'm hoping to add this coaching training to my current position as a business consultant.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you here and the PhD you're working on. You're being a little too modest.
I'm working on a PhD in industrial organizational psychology, as it's called an IO. And as an IO, basically you still deal with business and the consulting that is necessary to address problems in the workplace. But I've found that so often my sessions with employees of various companies always tend to have a personal bent, and oftentimes whatever problems they're having in the workplace are a direct result of something that's going on in their personal life. And I don't feel that I'm probably professionally equipped to handle that, and so I'm very excited to learn these coaching techniques that I think will meld well with my current position.
Super. So you plan to use the training to integrate with what you're doing as an IO consultant?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, terrific. Excellent. Well, welcome. That sounds exciting. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
You've been waiting a good time for this to start, so I'm glad we're finally doing it. So great.
Yes, thanks, David.
Absolutely. Wendy.
Hi. My name is Shakuntala Devi Wendy McDonald. I go by Shakuntala. Most of my friends call me Shakuntala. I am a spiritual life coach, a hypnotherapist. I do many healing modalities, and I am really excited to be here, and I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to integrate this coaching into my work yet, because, to be honest, I'm sorry I didn't get my bio in and do all of my homework, so I feel a bit unprepared. I've been just working nonstop for quite some time, and I just arrived in, I'm from Santa Monica, California, and I just arrived in Newport, Rhode Island for vacation, and to be honest, I've been working since I arrived, so it's good to slow down, and what am I going to do with this? I'm going to integrate it into my work, and I'm looking forward to how it's going to all unfold.
Super, and I'm glad you could join us even though you're on vacation. What would you most like to get out of our collaboration together as a group and the training itself?
I'd like to get more clarity on integrating. I guess I'm in the process of integrating all of my work together, so I'd like to gain more personal clarity in how I'm going to do that.
Okay. Okay. And you prefer Shakuntala?
Yeah.
Okay, got it. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And welcome. That's great. Olga.
Hello, my name is Olga Vasquez, and I'm from Chicago. I'm semi-retired. I retired now in June 2014, but I went back to work as a part-time. I retired from the Chicago Public Schools, and I've worked as a parent resource teacher and instructional coach, and now I'm helping to coordinate the parent involvement program at our school. And what's been missing for me, I went through these questions. As a coach, I think it was a well-defined niche. I think I'm getting one now. working with parents and working and talking more with divorced women and women of domestic violence. And I'm understanding that this is what's leading me to taking this training. I want techniques to help people through the changes in their lives. I think that people, primarily women, who have gone through either those instances that I've mentioned, divorce or domestic violence, or feel that they have nothing to contribute, or have lost themselves, I feel like I want to help them transform their old story, their old ways of viewing themselves into something new, someone new. A new story for themselves.
Terrific.
I'm here.
Okay, great. Something I'm doing that I'm able as dean of curriculum for CTA to make the decision to invite each of the three of you to a seminar series that I'm doing through CTA. It's a 4-part seminar series on change and transition. And I think it will be a nice supplement to what we do here. I don't really cover the same material, but I'd like to invite you. I will send you a link as soon as it's up. It's one of the Monday night Art and Science and Nuts and Bolts series, and it will be during the month of October. So it happens pretty soon. It's like 7 to 8 Monday evenings, Easterns, for 1 hour. And it has, there's online playback. There's not the MP3 download because CTA doesn't allow that, as you know from this, that there's just the online playback. But that, I think, might be an interesting addendum to what we're doing here because I put together a lot of material about coaching change and transitions. There's a little bit of an overlap, but it'll be kind of an application, I think, that might be especially of interest to you, Oka, and possibly all three of you, especially in a corporate setting, Amy, and with the kind of work that you're doing, Wendy. So I'll invite you, and I'll send you the link in case you might be interested in coming. So super, welcome. I'm going to keep kind of an open mic during this time, even during the seminar portion. Instead of putting us on lecture mode, I'm going to keep it open. I'll just ask for you to be aware of background noise or anything like that, and mute *6 if you don't have a headset, or just a little toggle switch if you do, so that we can keep it open for discussion if there's something that you want to interrupt me and clarify or ask about, so that you can do that. So let me just give you an idea of some of the things that we'll be doing. I want to look in our first seminar today at story as a metaphor to organize the coaching philosophy and system we're going to talk about over the next few weeks. And the coaching system is really looking at deconstructing how the mind and brain works to make changes that last, to look at how we can listen to someone's story, and really deconstruct meaning and look at how we can help someone to collaborate with them for change. So we'll spend seminars 2 through 5 on the roadmap system, which is the 7 steps, the acronym for the 7 steps to deconstruct a particular story and to reconstruct a new one. And we'll talk about some of the aspects of that as we go into it, because I want to illustrate it. Now, the exercises and the workbook you'll see in the curriculum, the workbook components are in gray, and they're organized in that way to correspond with a suggested use, or to sort of parallel the component of the curriculum that we're talking about. As my bonus, my gift to each of you, I'm going to have my fulfillment house send you the client workbook at the end of the training. It's a companion piece to the curriculum that you have or will have soon, and it's something that can be co-branded with your name on the cover and a new first page for your message and contact information, that sort of thing, if you want to use it with clients or with groups in a setting like that. So I would suggest that each of you do the exercises and the work pages along with the reading in the curriculum, because it will give you the best idea of how your clients might experience it to see what of those you might find useful with particular clients. And, of course, the best way to really help our clients understand and revise their stories or write new stories is for us to be really clear about our own story, told clearly in our own voice. And we'll be looking at the various stories that that our clients will be writing, from wellness to money to career to relationship, a whole number of things. So those are some of the things that that we're going to be doing. Also, in terms of a couple of other bonuses, I'm going to send you a copy of Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual, after a revision I'm making. And if you're interested, I have a brochure template that you can customize to market the programs. I'll also have a quarterly mentor group, and one of those will occur. It's the first Monday every 3 months, and the next will be the first Monday in November. It's where all the previous graduates who are licensed, specially certified, get together online and look at best practices, marketing successes. It's kind of a brainstorming and a mastermind group to look at all the things that can be done. Pretty inspirational and fun to listen to and get to know other people and to develop referral possibilities. The registry is there also for the registration of your contact information for individual and corporate. And the license fee, haven't really talked about that much, but it's included in the first year of training. And then after that, it's kind of a nominal $45 a semester to maintain the registry, the mentor groups, the white paper as part of each registry, and an ongoing referral network with the New Life Story group. So you have or will have the curriculum, Live a New Life Story, the Owner's Guide. You will be getting a copy of the workbook at the end. Notice, if you have it, in the curriculum, the glossary at the end. It's also available in the workbook for clients. It's kind of support material, and it's to spell out concepts and ideas that might be of help and of interest. And it's a good place. It was a good place for me to, a good excuse for me to put some of my favorite quotes. But I think you'll find it useful. And I'll mention that along the first couple of times when we come across something that's spelled out a little bit more in the glossary, if you're interested in more of maybe an addendum to what we do. So each module is a complete unit as well as being a component of a 10-part series. For example, some of the modules, like career, money, relationship, wellness, can be used as a template for mentor coaching, for seminars, for groups, or coaching packages. And, you know, we'll talk about some of the ways to apply and do that. Let me pause a moment. Any questions or things that would be helpful to talk about before I get into the material for the seminar today? Any housekeeping or other kind of questions that would be helpful?
David,
for us to, yes.
Oh, sorry, this is Amy. You referenced the gray areas on the pages, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to keep up. For instance, on 1.2, on page 1.2, it has a gray box, and in the top left-hand corner in parentheses, it says in workbook. So you're saying that we'll work through these during the course, and then what you actually provide at the end, the workbook that we can brand with our own company name, it'll have the exact same pages that we've gone over
exactly.
During the course?
Exactly. The beginning and the end, including like the glossary, are part of the client workbook, and then you'll see just those exercises. That there's an introduction. It's kind of an annotated deal. There's an introduction that probably is going to be very similar to what the introduction is, but then the exercises and work pages that are in gray, those are going to be also part of the client workbook, so that there's the possibility of having a client just do components of that. For example, I've done, there have been a couple of coaching groups that I've done. I do everything by telephone, and this was too. people who had done training with me, and one of them came up in the mentor group, wanted to do work in the workbook and talk about it. And like one group wanted to focus more on wellness, one group wanted to focus on the entire workbook. And to have a coaching group where they did the exercises, and then we'd meet together as a group and talk about it. And those kinds of groups work great to have a format like that where people are doing joint exercises and work pages, and then they have stuff that they discuss that they're experiencing or that they're working on and look at it and do it in a group. So the simple answer to what you said is yes. that's in the workbook. And that will be a separate document. It's a companion piece. It looks like it's related, but it's not exactly the same. You know, it's the plant workbook. Yeah, absolutely. Was there another comment or question?
Yeah, I have a question, Olga. Can we purchase these workbooks in bulk, or how do we?
Yes. I mentioned or just alluded to the MentorPath partners. I only have. As affiliates, people who have trained with me, because I know that they know the material and I consider it kind of a bonus to the people who train with me, that, for example, you can purchase the workbooks in bulk for 40% rebate and then charge a full amount. So you can make money on the work. Like the workbook, I believe, is $147, and you would pay like $78. And then when you order 10 or more, just the first time, and then you order as few as you want, I will have my graphics person do a co-branding, putting your name on the cover, and then a new first page. And when you order it in bulk, instead of paying like the cost plus $14.95 shipping, when it's shipped in bulk, it's less than a third of that total for shipping, and I pass that cost on to you. So you can make money just doing the workbooks. So and any of the MentorPath products, you do a 40% rebate. Now I have, and this is a little complicated, but I have a new series that I'm beginning called the NeuroMentor series, and I've. I think I sent out a mailing to everyone that you probably, and the affiliates there do 50%, and it's all digital. It's there are five recordings with outline. That the first one is kind of a introductory deal that is a hugely good price for five recordings, five outlines. It's like I think $137. It was just kind of an introduction. There will be others in the NeuroMentor series, and you're all, of course, welcome to do that if you're interested in doing that as an affiliate. So I know that was more complicated than you asked. I think, does that make sense to you?
Thank you.
Okay. Does that make sense? Does the answer make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Great. Other questions or comments? Okay, well let's start with the material, and again, don't hesitate to interrupt me at any point if there's a clarification or question, and I'll save some time at the end. Oh, one thing that the way I'd like to organize these is to have a period of discussion at the beginning, and I'll save some time at the end, and I'll only use up about 40 minutes in a presentation. That will really extend and apply the material, look at illustrations, bring in applications in a way that can make it more real and live and useful to you. In addition, there's no exam or anything in terms of the final certification. It's just, you know, being here, attendance, participation, that sort of thing. The only thing I would like you to do is to do a write-up using the roadmap system. And I'll send you a sample of this, an example of how to do it. And it's fairly short, and you can do it on yourself or on a client. And it ends up being 2.5 or 3 pages, double-spaced, using the roadmap system. and we'll spend a portion of some of the class time or a seminar time having you present, and then we'll do a brief discussion of it. So I'll send you a sample of this. You can see, you know, every person who's done it has found that it was significantly beneficial, whether they did it on themselves or on a client. Clients thought it was beneficial. And in fact, I just completed, from all the people who had done the training before, those who wanted to submit a roadmap case study, we put it together in a book. And I have a composite of all the cases at my editors now, and we're gonna do it as an ebook, and it'll be available on Amazon and a number of other places with as an ebook. So you'll get a chance to maybe see some of how beneficial these can be for, and I've organized the book according to what kind of roadmap case study it is, whether it's career or wellness or money or lifestyle, you know, whatever. So I think you'll find that beneficial and not a burden, and something that can be very informative. So I'll send a sample of that so you can see just one way of putting it together. Any other thoughts or clarifications before we start? Okay, well, super. As a kind of prologue to our work, every one of these sessions is recorded and will be available just to our group at the link that was sent around, or the link that you got actually when you registered. So that's the same link that you did the download of the outline of the syllabus with the assignment and the 28-week protocol. That's where the recordings will be posted for online playback. So in our first session, we'll talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new story. The remaining seminars will look at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change, beginning with the 7-step roadmap process to create a new story. And as I mentioned, I encourage you to do the exercises and work pages in the workbook portion. I want to encourage you to actively listen and understand your own story to apply the process. There was an article in the most recent Harvard Business Review that said the most salient quality of a CEO was the ability to develop reflective thinking. This is exactly what I'm talking about here, to be able to reflect on your process, your thinking and experience, to have insight and to really develop a mentalization about your own experience. When you've done it yourself, you're in the best position to coach it. When you made your own journey, you can best guide the client's journey. From a Chinese proverb, I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand. And from Columbia University, we remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. So my suggestion, put it into action. So write this question down, because I want to come back to it at the end of our training and see where you are. And I'd ask if each of you would manage the background noise. If you have background noise, you may not hear it, but your speaker receiver will pick it up, so you can always go on mute. Write this question down. What's my story? Now, think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in one sentence. Bullet your major storylines. Now, your story is not your bio. It's not your title. It's not your role. It's your story. Schedule a brainstorming session with yourself, I would suggest, to really think about what your story is. One of the things you bring as professional coaches that's unique, you're experts at change, choice architects. You facilitate and guide a client's life or wellness or other story. As we go through the seminars, think about your professional story. I have a white paper I'm going to send you about developing your professional story. work on how to convey your unique offering in a clear, brief, simple way that focuses on client benefits. Now, they also do a CTA seminar series in November. I'm not able on this one to invite you and get you in the back door. It's on persuasion, influence, and neuromarketing. It's something, it's the last one I put together. I'm really excited about, and I've done one trial so far. So I would recommend it. I'll tell you more about it if you're interested. So work on how to convey your unique offering in a clear, brief, simple way that focuses on client benefits. At a meeting recently, I heard David Plouffe, who originally was Obama's chief campaign strategist, who conducted his initial campaign internet approach, said it this way: be able to answer every crucial question in one sentence. And Einstein said it equally simply. He said, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. So here are some premises for our work together and the ideas of what it will be based on. Now, these are all in your outline. If you printed the outline, you have an annotated outline, so you don't have to write down a bunch of stuff. So you just kind of go through and listen and see what makes sense to you. So here are the premises. One, plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. For a life story, it's the outline of life narratives. The core assumptions of life stories inform what we look for and then how we attribute meaning to what we experience. Behavioral patterns and belief systems downloaded especially from parents and significant others in the first years of life become automatic to operate without observation or even awareness. Neuroscientists estimate that about 95% of our behaviors and core beliefs are pre-programmed in the unconscious mind and operate on autopilot. We rarely observe these patterns, but we only see derivatives of them to infer the belief systems that they're based on. So that means that we and our clients can create two stories simultaneously. The surface story is that we run our lives with conscious intentions and aspirations. This is what we're aware of. This is what includes what this is what I want from life. These are my positive goals. Yet the conscious mind is a tiny processor that controls the mind and brain systems less than 5% of the time. The shadow story is the unconscious story that ghostwrites behaviors at times in a different direction from conscious intention. So when your life and actions don't meet your aspirations, then look at the surface story and the shadow story. When a client wants to do something, has a plan to do something, but gets to the point and then doesn't do it, look at the shadow story. An example. Your surface story is, I want to generate more income and generate wealth. The shadow story is something that goes in the opposite direction, possibly. And the shadow story may say, well, you know, I just don't think I'm able. I don't think I have what it takes. I think it would be too much trouble, and I'm just as happy where I am. I'm going to choose the status quo. Or I wouldn't know really what to do. So we began to look at the surface story and the shadow story. And this is simply a coaching way of looking at what psychoanalysts would call conflict, and it makes it a here and now process that is absolutely based just on what's happening at this moment and the choice architecture of someone's both conversation and behavior. Two, second premise, we learn through stories. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, you know, I can remember something if I fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Our story, our brains need a story. Mira Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. For example, we personify the economy or the stock market as if each were a story of its own. We make a story out of events in order to infer a relationship or assign causality. If you want to take a look at an application of this, I won't go into this in any more detail here, but my current blog is to distinguish causation and correlation. Cause and correlation. It's an interesting, I thought it was kind of a funny story, and it's in my blog. You can sign up for the blog if you want, and it'll be delivered to your box each month. But it actually, the way my web guy has it revised now, it's on the home page of my website at the bottom of MentorPath. Three, we each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and our assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and how we process it. The brain needs a story. It will infer one, so it's helpful to know the lexicon. Our plot consists of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. We then generate our life narratives according to that plot, since mind and brain are both programmed to process by default mode and even to ignore facts that contradict our assumptions. In other words, we code our radar with our beliefs and then we perceive things that fit into it. I'll tell you a story of how that applies in just a moment. A life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumptions tell us what to look for as well as how to perceive and process our experiences. And some, in fact many, of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to ourselves. This is where we come in as mentor coaches. Gregory Maguire, for example, a best-selling novelist and playwright, most recently the Broadway hit Wicked, said, "You know, I didn't realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books who does not have a dead mother or a lost parent. Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. It was only after his 23rd book that he became conscious of the fact that, as he said, I can't seem to start a novel unless the character doesn't have a mother." He didn't realize it for all that time. And he further said, "If the mother's still alive, the mother was there, what's the problem? There's nothing to write about." Five, we believe and remember only that which fits our plot. In other words, what we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experience in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. In other words, for example, someone abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in future relationships, even though circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by our narrative plot.
Dr. Kruger, can you repeat what we expect in the present?
Yeah.
What
we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly what we experienced in the past.
Okay.
In other words, we tailor-made our own software to perceive and process that, and it's based on our experiences. So that's what we come to experience and expect. And our expectations not only help us see very quickly and instantly, but in fact they determine what we see. And they may blind us to others, to other things that we're not looking for, which is why people need mentor coaches. A simple example. A professor who is fond of telling stories will ask his class, close to the end of class, if they have time for him to tell them a story before they leave. They look at their watches and inevitably say yes. When he tells a story, he immediately asks them what time it is. They have to look at their watches again. This is completely understandable because their frame of reference for the initial question was to check their watches to see how much time remained, not what time it was, which was the second question. The first time they looked to see if there was enough time left before the class ended, not what time it was. If we look for one thing, we may miss another. 6. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Here's an example. This is out of Oxford a number of years ago. 2 anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. They entered the 2 ape colonies, lived for a year, didn't communicate, and when the 2 anthropologists emerged to compare notes, they expected essential similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. 1 anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a real harmony and unity, a real comfort with the apes, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of conflict, never achieved a harmony or unity with the ape group. The 2 anthropologists could not understand the discrepant result or find any reasons. They and their teams puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun had a belief and a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. 7. A story can define possibility. And you each know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. Then, in 1954, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Within the following 18 months, a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. And today, this is commonplace. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. 8. A story can actually define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient is prescribed an inert pill plus some expectations, in other words, a story. In the vast majority of cases, the story becomes reality. By anticipating an experience, we can create it. The story generates a truth so powerful that it can even reverse the pharmacological effect of a real medicine. The placebo is a white lie. It's a fiction that becomes a truth. In fact, a recent MIT study showed that a more expensive placebo worked significantly better than a much cheaper one. Same placebo, different stories. And this isn't about being gullible or suggestible. For example, when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. Medical research, in fact, shows that over 70% of successful non-surgical treatments are the result of the patient's belief that the treatment will work. And this is based on the physician's belief that the treatment will work. There's that kind of emotional contagion, midbrain to midbrain, between physician and patient. We'll return to that. 9. A story can actually take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling that someone creates can be perceived to act on its creator. So here's some ways that we can see ourselves as the victims of the stories that we create rather than the author. My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. we ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations and then make ourselves the victim of the very story we create. Another example of the power of story is a woman I know who recalled an incident many, many years ago from her adolescence. She attended an all-girls boarding school. She said, "At one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked, and everybody got drunk." 10. Your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say and do is about yourself. What you say about me tells me about you. And everyone is always making self-statements. And this is something I'd suggest you take a look at in the glossary. There's a little bit more of an explanation and some examples there. So, practically speaking, you define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves, to make them feel better, what they want or don't want to own, what they want to disavow or project. And a practical application here is when you're working with a client is always showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. And if you think about it in that way, rather than, for example, seeing something as resistance or seeing client is trying to defeat you or get the better, it can help you understand how to engage because they're doing the very best job possible, showing you exactly what it's like to be them. In other words, they're going with you to recreate the same behavior patterns, the same attachment patterns that they have with other people, some of which are compromising and need to be adjusted or revised in order for them to be more successful. So how they play out, who they are and what they do and how they interact with people as they do it with you, this is where we really earn our money. Because this is not talking about something out there like a good strategy and setting a goal and creating the steps to get there. This is, it comes alive in vivo within the relationship with you. And this is where you need to be able to have the working alliance and the empathic approach to be able to get away with saying exactly what you need to say to help somebody work on something, to have insight, to reflect, and to go through change of something as basic and fundamental as who they are. We'll return to that. 11. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation originally came from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. And 12. And I think this is really, really huge. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. Think about how contagious your belief system is. An authentic belief in someone, in your client, activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. This one comes from neuroscience, now even though good parents have known this for centuries. And we'll talk later about how that works and how to work it. But it is why I believe the most important thing that we can do or be with a client is to believe in that client. And that's why I work only with a client in whom I totally believe. And I know that that client will teach us both why. Now, a footnote here. I expect you'll have some questions about some of what I said. And one closure is to attach familiar associations and put it in a familiar container, which is the old story, as you'll see your clients do. Another is to keep it open and remain in curious exploration of new meanings and possibilities, which is the new story. And that's, of course, what we hope with clients, too. And each of the points that I've raised here are themes that we'll return to and develop and weave together throughout this experience. Now, I want to move to a component here to begin to introduce the notion of why we resist change. But I want to pause. Are there any questions or comments or things you'd like to discuss so far? And don't hesitate to jump in or ask or comment in any way.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
That's good.
Sure, Shakuntala. Would you repeat number 11? I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me.
Let's see, number 11. Oh, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change.
And what did you say after that?
Number 12, or just the explanation?
Explanation.
Oh, that neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. In other words...
Pure facts?
I'm sorry?
Did you say pure facts are a myth?
Yeah, pure facts are a myth.
Okay, that's what I missed.
Which means, one application here is that as you and the client begin to examine his or her story, just the process of the client reflecting on it, the process of creating an experience of both of you together looking at it is going to change the story in itself, in addition to the content and the process of what you will come to in doing this.
Yeah.
So does that make sense?
Absolutely. Thank
yeah,
you.
Okay. Yeah, there was another question at the same time.
I had a question. This is Amy. I've been writing as quickly as I can to get all this down, and I was particularly interested in some of the ones that you had data to support them. It seems that the people that I work with are very data-driven, and if I could supply some of those, they'd be able to buy into this and really embrace it. And I was looking through Module 1, hoping maybe it was listed in there. Is there somewhere that this is written? I don't want to ask you to repeat yourself, but I got some of the notes, but not all of them.
If I'm hearing your question, that's why it's recorded, so you can go back over the material. If you're asking me if I have referenced each of the things that I've mentioned, no, I don't, simply because this is for practical application.
No, I don't need references, actually. I didn't even think about that. I can just go back and listen to the recording again and just push pause and write them all down. That's perfect.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a way you can fast forward and pause and rewind. You'll see the instructions when you get there when it is posted.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
But can we download those for our file?
This is through CTA, and they don't allow a download.
Okay.
You know, I do on all the things I do through MentorPath for an MP3 download, but CTA doesn't allow that, so I'm sorry that that's not a possibility. I know that would be convenient.
Okay.
And I'm petitioning, but some things I haven't been able to pull off just yet. Other comments or questions? Good questions and good comments. I appreciate it.
By the way, they have those posters. When you change the way you look at things, I have one.
Oh, really?
Things you look at change, and that's helped me through many issues here.
Yeah. I mean, that's something, in my first 25 years as a psychiatrist psychoanalyst, I had to be aware of in doing research and clinical research, and just the process of looking at something, you know, of course, adjust it. So the inferences that we make, we have to be careful, but just the process of engaging with someone as a client, as a coach, you are creating a new attachment pattern. And think about the attachment patterns that have been there, downloaded from early experiences with someone, and they've repeated them. And you're not only creating a different kind of attachment pattern in which you don't react or you're not enticed or provoked to react in the same way as other people in that client's life, you're also not only creating something different and creating a model of actively using empathy and reflective thinking that the client will internalize, but you're also looking at the process itself as an entity of what the client can understand, the insight and understanding that someone can have in doing this and developing an ability to look at themselves and develop this reflective functioning and mentalization, which is to think about how they're thinking. So it's a powerful, powerful process of change. And that's what I want to spend a bit more time on, looking at the seven-step process to really look at this as a systematic way of doing something, and to introduce change as well in the discussion.
Thank you.
Super. So let me ask overall, before we get into the specifics, why do you think we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What are your thoughts right now about why we resist change? Anyone?
It's comfortable the way we are. It's what we know.
Absolutely. We know the outcome. We know exactly how it's going to turn out, and we sometimes mistake predictability for effectiveness. Of course, it's going to turn out the same way, but we know what it's going to be like. Like kids who watch a movie 98 times, you know, it's predictable. And they learn to mouth the words, and they can say, it's a real sense of effectiveness to know exactly. And the brain wants effectiveness. So, yeah, any other thoughts about it?
Well, yes, there's security in the certainty. I mean, we all desire it on some level or another, and that security is there with the certainty.
Exactly, exactly, absolutely.
Even if it's negative, even if it's bad certainty, it's certainty for many people. That's a hard habit to break.
Absolutely, yeah, great responses. So even when people do what they know, when they don't do what they know they need to do for themselves, when they repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder and expect a different result, even if it leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or a glass ceiling in endeavors or disappointing relationships, people will repeat. Nassim Taleb and the Black Swan asks, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So, as you've each mentioned, part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat because it's our comfort zone. It's secure, as you mentioned, predictable. And a comfort zone can be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default model. We repeat because we know how it'll turn out, which creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of identity, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. We return to our default mode. And this is the most powerful force of the human psyche, that we return to our identity. So if someone does something or engages in a piece of behavior that is different, unless that's incorporated into how and who they see themselves, which is the last step of the roadmap, the P on roadmap, program new identity, then they will revert back to doing things the way they did them before. So just to give you a brief example of how we return to our default mode, if you can free both hands, put your palms together in front of you, and put them together firmly and interlock your fingers very firmly so that it's a very, very tight grip. Now, notice exactly where your fingers, your thumbs are. Keeping your fingers exactly where they are, switch your thumb so the other thumb is on top instead. Yeah, now how does that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Now move your thumb back to the original place. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante. Add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We'll talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. Because there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. The other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist, Milton Erickson, told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that every person who followed him followed the same path Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its circuitous route. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. And as he did this again and again, he would have more twists and turns, really diabolical. Each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. Now, this is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're really circuitous. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be introduced and developed outside the cycle of experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. Catalyst for insight, a novel stimulus, new information, new context. That's exactly what we're experts at. We are catalysts to look at things in a different way. Instead of looking at problems, which goes back into the groove that's already there and deepens it, even if the purpose is to resolve it or work it through or come to the end of the old story, which is what therapy does, it grooves that pathway even more deeply. Looking at things in a new way, looking at possibility, creates new connections in the brain. Now, we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engage new behavior. The newness, the uncertainty, can be read as evidence not to proceed. It can even be read incorrectly as intuition of a wrong choice. Well, my gut told me that this was not the right thing, which is the read of discomfort in an old model. Or it can be also read in an old model was anxiety equals danger ahead, better head for cover. So that's why not only the story must be created in a new and different way, but also the model that one uses, one's own identity, to house that story, to parallel and incorporate that story as part of an identity also needs to change as well. Because then the uncertainty and the anxiety can be validation of doing something new, a signpost of change and progress. So discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. It will be with every one of your clients. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism that's really close to the emotional center that when we try something new, reads as, this isn't normal. Now, we'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. And I wonder, I'll return to this, but as we're talking about the seven steps and some of the brain components of this. So, not only do we actively construct stories, but our brain continually edits at the same time. An example, and you've probably seen this, I've seen it a number of times, an example or variations of it. An example is a classic study in which an audience is asked to watch several people dribbling and passing a basketball among themselves. Their job, to count the number of passes each person makes during a 1 minute period. Intense concentration is needed because the ball moves really quickly. Then someone dressed in a gorilla suit crosses the floor, walks through the players, turns to the viewer, thumps his chest in the middle of the screen, and then walks off the other side of the screen. How many people saw such an obvious phenomenon? Researchers Daniel Simons and Christopher Chabris found that slightly under 50% of people noticed the gorilla. Slightly over 50% of people failed to notice the gorilla entirely. This inattentional blindness is our brain at work trying to construct meaningful and consistent narrative from an inconsistent world. Things that don't fit our storyline simply get unconsciously edited or don't even register as being relevant. So, listen for the power of story. Your brain can rewire new experiences, practice consistently, form new neuronal pathways and new neural networks in your brain. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expression. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. also from the Black Swan. Ideas come and go, stories stay. I want to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Now, I think at least one of you have been with me in a different context and know the study. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from pools of contrasting behaviors, like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would draw this and then pick what they wanted to do. So they would behave according to the assignment. So someone would act like an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they had to stretch to choose to do something outside their usual pattern. They had twice a week to eat something they would have never eaten before, and twice a week to read something they would never have read before. So what do you think, after 4 months, was the biggest change in this group? What's your guess? Take a wild guess.
They became more alive.
Okay, good guess. Any others?
What did she say? I'm sorry, I didn't hear her.
Take a guess what was the biggest change. You want to repeat that?
Sure. I said they became more alive.
Okay. Any other guesses?
Maybe they just became more open to change in general.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. And specifically, the remarkable finding was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, all had kept the weight off, most continued to lose weight. Now, this had nothing to do with a diet, but a study focusing on change and its impact. Now, what happened was, requiring people to change routine behavior made them actually think about their decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without even thinking about it. Now, in coaching, I'd call this story busting. When the participants actually process decisions actively, they exercise choice. This conscious decision process extended to other choices, such as what to eat, what to do, what not to do. So, basically, this came to be almost for every person to recognize that everything they do is a choice. Whatever they eat is a choice. Most even came down to the specific awareness that this bite is a choice I make. And they then began to ask, is this choice in my best interest? So as coaches, we are choice architects to help a client be aware that a choice right now, in this moment, is the story she's writing. It's not there until it's lived. Every day is a blank page. It's not there until we create it. So once becoming actively aware of making choices, we can decide what's in our best interest, what furthers our story, and what doesn't. And if you want to try to understand something, change it. So here's an example from executive mentor coaching. Brian was working successfully at a new CEO position. 3 months earlier, he advanced from COO at another corporation. He was doing a great job in his first 100 days. One session, he departed from our discussion of success strategies to say that he had a fear that he would somehow sabotage his new achievements. He said that he regularly stopped at a convenience store to eat candy before he got home so his wife wouldn't see him. I asked how he decided to stop each time. He responded by calling it sneak eating, said he hadn't told his wife, and recognized he didn't answer my question. I said, what do you say to yourself the instant you decide to sneak eat? Well, he wasn't sure. And I wanted to know specifically the conversation he had with himself the instant that led to his conclusion to get the candy. Well, he said he wasn't sure. He hadn't thought about it. Well, I knew that. An impulse fuses urge with action to collapse that contemplative space where reason resides. In that space is what's in my best interest. So I prompted. In other words, the instant you decide, do you bargain with yourself to say, well, I'll do better next week and I won't stop next week? Or do you oppose your own authority to say, I'll do whatever I want? Or do you feel some overwhelming urge that hijacks your judgment? Brian recognized a conversation with himself that went, to hell with it, I'll eat whatever I want. Nobody's around to stop me. He recognized that the result, though, was the abandonment of his own principles. I noted that in the story he was writing, he farmed out his authority to his wife as if she were the obstacle. He kept the other half, the desire, as if he were getting away with something. He created the illusion that he triumphed when his wife didn't see him. We talked then about the stress of his being a more ultimate authority now than ever before in his life, his first CEO position. He acknowledged his choice to not be his own authority in this one specific circumscribed area. His question was, how do I get it back? And I said, the question isn't how do you get it back, but how do you not give it away? It's yours. You're the author of your story. And then I added, it sounds like you're not being loyal to yourself. He recognized he was writing a storyline that he detested. As we talked about it in more depth, we could then apply this process to expand his success in his company as well as his life, and looking at living up to his own ideals, having him being clear to his own ideals. So, in summary now, here are some principles that focus on facilitating change, which is really the preface to looking at living a new story. One, each person's life story is created. In adulthood, you create whatever you think, feel, and experience each moment. Every day is a blank page until you begin writing on it, even though it may seem to the individual to be just the way things are. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. Now, you may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. I plagiarized that from an old codger who was on my team on an alcohol treatment unit. He was a counselor, and he said, Dave, you're welcome to use that. And I said, I guarantee you I will. People are going to benefit from that. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you almost always know what it isn't. Three, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. This establishes the beginning of a sense of effectiveness and mastery. The antithesis is somebody tells you what to do. An example of this, if you look at someone's fMRI when they have a moment of insight, an aha moment, three different parts of the brain light up, and they're vaulted into a different state of mind that's more synthetic and integrative and creative. When you tell them what to do, give them a fact or instruction, nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. Four. We don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Our assumptions manifest as feelings and behaviors, so that's how we can know what beliefs are. And simply the question, well, how do you really know that? Will generate, usually, the belief from a client. When you make assumptions explicit, you more clearly see which facilitate and which interfere. Five, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. Six, small changes lead to big changes. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify progress. This is exactly what we do in coaching in a very simple way. We shrink the change. We make the change specific, measurable, simple. Seven, problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected. To resolve a problem, even emotionally to come to the end of the past, does not create a blueprint for success. This is one of the reasons there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees. Strategic plans for specific goals are necessary. If something's a totally new experience, someone needs a guide, whether that's in coaching or even for a healthier diet or exercise. Eight, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. Nine, you need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. The end should be in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. "Which road do I take?" she asked. "Where do you want to go?" responded the Cheshire Cat. "I don't know," Alice answered. Then said the cat, "It doesn't matter." 10. You need the correct paradigm. A paradigm is an internal map, the way you see, interpret, and understand something. It needs to be correct. If you're in Dallas and need to navigate the city, a map of Houston is useless no matter how hard you try. And it needs to be current, not a paradigm from an old story. 11. Decide what you want. Believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception, just like the filter on a camera alters the image that gets recorded on the camera. And we now know that our beliefs can actually turn genes on or off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are only limited to the ones we allow ourselves to see. And here's a very brief story I want to close with, so we'll have some time for discussion. An example of a belief coupled with a goal. A destitute young housewife had almost no money. She couldn't afford a babysitter or a computer, but she had a story to tell, and she was determined to do that. She decides to write. As soon as she starts writing, her mother dies at age 45 from multiple sclerosis. Her marriage to an abusive husband ends in a divorce. She has a miscarriage. She gets fired from her job and lives on government welfare. She takes her baby to a coffee shop in the middle of the afternoon and writes on a legal pad while her baby takes a nap. She does this every day, 7 days a week, for 4 years. And then, after much work, she finally found a publisher for Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your thoughts and questions now. I know this is a broad overview, but it's really a look at using story as a metaphor, as a beginning way to think about how we can listen to and process what we're hearing in one respect from our clients. Thoughts, questions? Does this make sense to you, first of all?
Yes.
It makes a lot of sense. This is a lot of information right now.
Yeah.
I know. I struggle with that because there's so much I want to give to you, but I know that it doesn't allow us to develop a real discussion in a true seminar format because there's so much I want to convey that's in addition to the curriculum. Yes, I talked over someone.
No, there's a lot of great information here and a lot of great things to be aware of. It's just I have to digest it all myself.
It does take a while to marinate. And I think the putting it into a practical focus once we go through the roadmap to really do a case study using this system can really bring it home and maybe illustrate for you how it can work for you and how much you'd like it to work for you.
Yeah, it's really exciting how logical it is, just the way that it's so logical. There's things you don't ever think about, but then when you're saying it, David, it's so logical, and it's easy to absorb and to accept that it's such a great idea to go about it this way. I don't know why we don't think about it more often, but this is such a great idea to replace the life story, to break the habits the way you're saying to do so.
Yeah, some of the things that I'm talking about, and especially some of the ways we'll talk about how our mind works and how our brains work, are so simple, they're almost elusive. I mean, they're just so simple when we think about it, but then it's sometimes, one of the things that's really always intrigued me is to put together and synthesize very complex information from mind and brain sciences, especially, to look at how we can talk about and think about this in the simplest way to make it really useful so that somebody can really get their arms around it and create change, and that we can do that as coaches. I mean, you are going to be among a very elite group of people who truly understand the mind and brain sciences applied to strategic coaching that can really, better than any other group of people, I believe, help people make changes that last.
Mm-hmm.
And however you want to apply that. Well, we're out of time. Thank you all so much. I'm excited about our group and our beginning. I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. If any of you have any questions or anything, jot them down. We'll talk about them at the discussion part of next time, or anything you'd like to email me about, feel free to do that. I'll probably want to discuss it at the beginning of next time, too. So we'll always have a time at the beginning and the end to look at any challenges or issues in the reading or in your reflection or application of this yourself as you do the exercises. Or especially, I think it can be very helpful for us to talk about clients or vignettes to look at applying this in ways that can be useful to you, and it can be useful to all of us to look at a case study, or maybe have one kind of ongoing that we revisit from time to time. So think about what you'd like to bring and talk about and benefit our group with. So thanks very, very much. Look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Bye now.
Thank you.
Bye, David. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.